Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello and welcome to the Red Box Politics podcast from The Times. I'm Matt Chorley. Please only continue listening if you've washed your hands. The government is setting out its battle plan to tackle the spread of coronavirus, with early polling suggesting the public thinking it's handling the crisis well. So today we're going to take a look at where things are looking less rosy. Rachel Sylvester takes us inside the extraordinary story of Priti Patel versus, well, just about everyone. Will Tanner, a former Downing Street advisor, warns the fabric of society is fraying. And Matt Ford, a former Labour advisor turned stand-up, who's on tour right now with his show Brexit Pursued by a Bear, turns his attention to the breakout star of Labour's deputy leadership contest, Richard Burgum. Welcome to you all. I assume you're all coronavirus free.
I think so.
Hands washed. Although shaking of how we all shook hands before we started, because Matt Hancock said that was fine, and he definitely knows what he's doing. Let's get down to business and kick off. This is Rachel Sylvester.
In one of Aesop's fables, the sun and the wind test their strength by having a competition to make a man remove his cloak. When the wind blows as hard as it can, he just wraps it more tightly around him, but the heat of the sun makes him take it off. The moral of the story, that persuasion is sometimes more effective than force, is one the government needs to learn following the extraordinary resignation of Sir Philip Putnam as Permanent Secretary at the Home Office. Ministers and Downing Street advisers are good at huffing and puffing against the civil service, but now they need to show a bit more warmth.
I think this is a fantastic metaphor for summing up basically what's wrong with the Dominic Cummings going around blowing everyone. That's not a terrible. Excellent. We've reached the tone of the podcast. But this idea that you basically just go around and force everyone to do what you want.
Well, the trouble is that you have to have people on your side if you're going to deliver and implement things. And if you just go around making enemies, and Dominic Cummings and Michael Gove did it at the Department for Education when they denounced all the teachers and officials as the blob. And actually, I think they'd have managed to achieve a lot more if they'd had more people on their side. And if you just go around making enemies, denouncing Whitehall as the roadblock to reform, and allegedly, in the case of some ministers, bullying your staff even, you're never going to have people really engaged and enthused with your programme.
And you mentioned bullying. The Philip Ruttman resignation at the weekend was extraordinary. I mean, We've got pretty used now to cabinet ministers resigning. It's not even really worth stopping what you're doing to notice that happening. But for a senior civil servant to go on live telly to accuse a cabinet minister of being a lying, swearing bully, and then accuse the government of trying to basically hush him up with some money and then say he wants to take him to court was just amazing.
It was completely extraordinary. It was the sort of public pronouncement. And I think he said it was because he wanted to protect his colleagues and he wants to really challenge the culture publicly. And it shows how widespread the concern is. And remember, the government's already facing another constructive dismissal case for Sonia Khan, who was ousted as a special advisor to Sajid Javid, marched out by an armed police officer after a row with Dominic Cummings. And in fact, we interviewed Sajid Javid last week. He said he thought she would get a lot of money out of the taxpayer.
I suppose it also sort of speaks to the the wider problem of who wants to run the Home Office if Priti Patel is there, who wants to be an advisor to the Chancellor, who is any good, who doesn't, who would give up a, maybe a job in the a decent, well-paid job in the private sector for a job in government, which might last a fortnight?
And getting shouted at and undermined. And I think that's why the Downing Street attempt to sort of mount a takeover of the Treasury matters, because you need a sort of sense of rival, not exactly rival power bases, but balancing power bases in Whitehall, that you don't have this whole centralised bureaucracy. There's a sort of irony that Dominic Cummings loves this idea of self-regulating systems, you know, it's all like an ant colony or whatever. But actually, all his feedback
loops... I've not read that blog.
No, all his feedback loops link back to number 10. So it's all this kind of incredibly centralised machine with this slight culture of fear at the centre. And you're never going to run a successful business organisation, let alone government, which is a huge operation without that. And you sort of, ministers always sort of complain about they pull the levers of power and nothing happens. But if you rip the, all the levers out and start throwing
and
them around,
clobber your staff,
clobber
with,
your staff with them, then you're never going to achieve anything.
What do you make of this, Will? Is sunshine and warmth better sometimes than wind blowing?
Well, I spent 3 years in the Home Office and I genuinely woke up every day for those 3 years not knowing what the system was going to throw at me. I mean, the Home Office is an extraordinarily complex and risky place to work, and there is clearly a lot of kind of security and other demands on the Home Secretary. So, I mean, I have some sympathy for a Home Secretary who wants to do things her way and is demanding about what she expects from officials. However, I remember Theresa every year standing in front of the entire Home Office saying, what you do is important. You are a great Department of State, and trying to reverse some of the culture of fear and concern about competence that was still a kind of legacy of the not fit for purpose era under John Reid. And I think the culture in the Home Office really does matter. And there is a need for the Home Office to have a Secretary of State and a senior civil service that are working hand in glove in tandem rather than at odds from one another.
And you worked as well with Nick Timothy and Fiona Hill, who were the previous set of advisors who were accused of being heavy-handed. Do you think they went too far and that backfired in some cases?
Or? Nick and Fee were very demanding of the civil servants they worked for, but actually if you talk to civil servants who worked with Theresa and them in the Home Office, and indeed people in Number 10, they would say that I think largely they had a huge amount of respect for the conviction and the clarity of the mission that came with those two advisors. And actually, I don't think necessarily being a kind of demanding, conviction-driven Secretary of State or as a kind of team advisors is necessarily a bad thing, but it's the manner in which that's delivered and the relationships right at the top. The one thing I would say, though, this is a government that's just been elected on a massive mandate. If the civil service is pushing back on that, then I think there is a serious question about who is in charge.
But to what extent, just because you've got a big mandate from the electorate, doesn't mean everything that you want to do is a good idea. And the problem is that a new cabinet minister comes and says, I want to do this. And the civil service might say, well, we've tried this 5 times before and I can tell you it won't work.
Or it's illegal.
Or it's illegal.
That was the thing that I thought actually was the most worrying about the stories about Rutnam, is that he was pushing back against things that were sort of outside the rule of law, which is completely proper and right that he should.
But that's what
do.
I mean. So, to one extent, it's a civil service job to say, we've tried this before, it's a bad idea. The minister, though, hears, oh, biased Ramona Blob trying to get in the way of me with my great big mandate doing what I want to do. And actually, they could sort of both be right sometimes.
Yeah, definitely. And just on the legal point, I mean, I remember getting legal advice on various immigration tribunals and all the rest of it in the Home Office, where the Home Office legal department would say you've got a 25-30% chance of success. Theresa would be adamant that we were going to contest these decisions, and then we won those cases. So, like, contesting legal advice is part and parcel of being a government. And I don't think, I mean, I don't know the specifics of that case, but it certainly should be the case that Secretaries of State should push back on the legal advice of their departments in the interests of taxpayers, because sometimes they are right. But I mean, you're right, Matt, that I mean, having a big mandate does not mean that your policies are necessarily going to work. But ultimately, secretaries of state are accountable, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they're democratically accountable. And if those policies don't work, then they are the people, as Amber Rudd discovered, whose head's on the chopping block. And actually, permanent secretaries often don't have that type of accountability.
Does it make you long, Matt, for the warm, cuddly days of New Labour? I was astonished.
So many things do.
I was astonished to read at the weekend that even Alistair Campbell wrote a piece in the Sunday Times, basically telling Dominic Cummings to dial it down a bit. He sort of, I was strong-willed or something, but steady on, old chap.
But I mean, Alistair Campbell's a really good case study of people who, the outside world would look at him and say, oh, he's a bit of a bully. Actually, he was a hugely inspirational figure, and the people who worked for him found him to be warm and decent, a great defender of his staff. He was robust in the role that he had. I don't think he ever bullied a member of staff. I don't think those accusations were ever levelled at him. And I think some people misunderstand the role of senior political staff, and there's a machismo that goes with it. My experience of working for, I'm sure lots of people in this room may well have worked for bullies, people listening may well have done. There's a short-term hit that a bully can deliver through fear. In the medium to long term, they're the most ineffective people to work for because it's demotivating, it's depressing working for those people. And fundamentally, I think in politics, it's an awful trait.
And in the end, people either sort of down tools or leave altogether.
Yes, that's exactly.
And you get
what
less
happens,
out of
yeah.
them. Yeah, yeah.
And also, I think in the end, often people bully because they're quite weak and they don't really know what they're doing, and they're sort of shouting louder to cover something
they're
up.
Thick, nearly always.
Yeah.
Thick.
Well, in fact, one of Priti Patel's former ministerial colleagues said to me yesterday, she was vile, pushy, horrid, thicko. So she's not popular among her. She's not popular among her conservative colleagues. Never mind the civil service.
And what's really interesting, just on coronavirus, is that we are now seeing what happens when a government has to lean on the system to prepare for and deliver a massive national effort. That actually this isn't about, oh, you weren't very in favour of Brexit, or, you know, you're dragging your heels on this. You know, fundamentally, the government and the system are going to have to work together really closely, aren't they, Will, over the next few weeks and months?
Oh, completely. And you would, any cracks in the system between civil servants and secretaries of state is going to potentially have consequences for people's lives. I mean, that is something that ministers need to take seriously. I thought it was notable Matt Hancock went on the Today programme this morning, and the kind of blanket ban has been broken for coronavirus. But the system does need to work together, and it is clearly the case that civil servants and ministers need to have a good working relationship in order to deliver for voters.
Well, we brace ourselves to see when coronavirus hits, and also to see whether or not Priti Patel hits, presumably, as well. But in the meantime, let's move on and talk about what is happening, dare I suggest, outside the actual Westminster bubble. This is Will Tanner.
The faster the world turns, the tighter we seem to try to hold on. The trappings of the modern world were meant to emancipate us, but two-thirds of people today crave security over freedom and worry that community is in decline. Many of the threads of our social fabric have frayed in the post-war battle between the party of the state and the party of the individual. Post-Brexit conundrum for both is how to become the party of community.
So, Will, you, having escaped from Downing Street, set up the Onward think tank. You've got a report coming out this week into how to repair the social fabric. But it's fascinating. So you've done a big poll asking people how they feel about the place they live. 7 in 10 believe that their community has declined in their lifetime. 6 in 10 think that there should be a duty to protect local institutions like pubs and post offices from closure. 1 in 4 people now say that none or few of their neighbours can be trusted. It's a sort of, it's a really depressing picture that you're painting.
Yeah, well, I think if you go to towns and villages and the suburbs of cities around the country and you talk to people about what concerns them, the things that matter to them are not kind of big ideological concerns. They're quite small and they're quite sociological. So it's the kind of decaying high street. It's the neighbourhood where people are increasingly anonymous. It's the fact that the relationships to family are kind of being disintegrated by modern life and kind of growing mobility and things like that. And actually, that's something that that is probably top of the list for citizens, but falls quite far down the list for politicians. I mean, we hear from politicians about things like the stakeholder economy, which was Tony Blair's great phrase, or the big society from David Cameron. Theresa May, when I worked for her, spoke about the shared society. But actually, in terms of
none of those things mean anything to anyone, though, do they?
Well, they are sound bites, but actually, the problem is that they aren't followed up with practical action. And we have let, I think, the social fabric of our places deteriorate over time, and people do feel quite a strong sense of detachment and rootlessness. And to some extent, I think that's starting to have political consequences. So the Brexit vote is a good example of it.
Well, I was going to say that actually that sort of sense of, oh, it's not as good round here as it used to be, and maybe this is a way of sending a message to someone that something ought to be done about it. Do you think that played a part in the Brexit vote?
Yes, I mean, I think too often we characterise this as nostalgia, and it's not always nostalgic. I mean, when we ask people whether or not they want things to change, they say yes, they are in favour of kind of forward-looking change. It isn't just all harking back to the past, but there is very much a sense that that connection and kind of togetherness has been lost from society, and some of the institutions which used to underpin that, whether that's the kind of post office or the pub or the thriving high street, they have not just gone or kind of faded, but they haven't been replaced by other forms of mutual engagement and kind of common betterment. And I think there's a real challenge for politicians now, especially in a kind of post-Brexit world where kind of community and social fabric is right at the top of the political agenda, about actually how they're going to repair some of those ties that bind us together.
Is it real, the perception and reality? Because I remember towards the end of last year, I did a podcast in my old hometown of Taunton, and we're speaking to people about just what the town was like, and got a whole load of people, oh, it's terrible, look at it around here, look at all the empty shops. And actually, where I was standing, we couldn't see any empty shops, and actually there were better shops there now than when I lived there. But there's just, when people have this sense, you know, and actually if you go a bit further out the town centre, there are former empty shops. Once people get this sense of everything's going a bit to the dogs, they see it where they didn't see it before. And so is this a people's sense of what it's like now borne out by sort of, if you can, you know, count those things?
Well, that's exactly what our two-year cross-party review is going to do. And I think it's notable that we've got Labour, Conservative, former SNP politicians on the review. I think it demonstrates a degree of cross-party consensus on this issue. But in terms of data, I mean, the number of pubs has declined by a quarter in the last 20 years. The number of post offices has declined by more. The number of libraries has declined by a quarter. There is a much higher degree of vacancies in terms of high streets than we've had for many years. So yes, I mean, there is quite clear data demonstrating a decline in community. And also things like civic participation, volunteering, the giving back to community in terms of time and resources is definitely in decline too. But what we haven't done, and this is what we're trying to set out, is actually try and measure that in a meaningful way. So Robert Putnam in the US did a really fantastic study called Bowling Alone 20 years ago. We haven't done a similar exercise in this country to understand how community is changing. So that's what we're trying to do.
It's all our fault, isn't it, Rachel? If you don't go to the pub or the post office, it shuts down.
Well, and also there may be fewer pubs, but maybe there are more wine bars or restaurants or other places that people are meeting. So I think I do understand the concern about particularly the decline of the high street, and that's a lot to do with online shopping, I guess. But I worry a bit about the kind of cultural conservatism that is somehow sometimes overlaid onto this discussion by both left and right, actually. So you have the sort of blue Labour and then also the, what they call it, Red Tory,
yeah.
I suppose. And that sense that actually it is slightly nostalgic, the world was a better place. And what does it mean for people? So actually, you know, communities are changing. In my view, that's a good thing, that it's more mixed, more migrants. What does it mean for working women? Actually, sometimes this agenda implies that women are much better in the home, you know, stay-at-home mums in the days when they, you know, pick the children up from school every day and had supper on the table for the husband. I don't want to go back to that world. And I think sometimes it's a sort of backward-looking... I think there's a practical thing about what do you do about the fabric of high streets, and actually saving pubs is fantastic, and post offices and libraries. But there's a separate thing, which is a whole load of other cultural values that I think are sometimes put on top of it.
So I think you're right. I mean, clearly there are people worried about the decline of the traditional family, for example, or kind of declining rates of religious attendance, things like that. I mean, our studies are kind of, we are looking at those things, but not from a perspective of one form is better than the other, or we're kind of trying to be guided by evidence. But there is a very clear sense from polling data and all the work that we've done that people do feel quite a strong sense of loss of belonging. I would challenge the idea that that is instinctively or inherently nostalgic. I don't think it necessarily is, but I think there is definitely something about people feel more fragmented and rootless than they perhaps expect or want to be, and perhaps since they did in the past. But that doesn't necessarily mean the ways in which they get those roots or the way they get that connection has to be the same as in the past. So it might be through different forms of family, through more diverse communities, through changing forms of engagement. It doesn't have to be the same as in the past, but the kind of the connection and the value that we get from the relationships that we have with one another and the institutions which underpin our shared lives, that is something to be valued and treasured and replenished over time. And I think the sense is that that's being lost.
Mm. What we really need, Matt, is a sort of network of state-run pubs, isn't it?
I don't know. I mean, I wonder how new these concerns are. I mean, you're right that in terms of the numbers of pubs closing, but are people more concerned about this than they were, say, 20 years ago?
So all of our data suggests that this trend is moving in the wrong direction. And certainly, if you look at kind of revealed preference, how much people are actually going out into their community to do things, whether that's to give money, to give time, to volunteer and take part in civic activity, that is certainly in very strong decline and has been declining for some time under governments of all stripes. So this is, and there are lots of people who attribute this just to spending reduction. Actually, this is something that's been going on for at least 10, 20 years.
Just before we move on, do you think you can trust your neighbours, each of you? Can you trust your neighbours, Will?
Eddie and Lucy are fantastic people.
Very good.
Yeah, I know all my neighbours. I'm in a sort of Hackney in East London, and I know most of my neighbours. It's a fantastic community.
Matt? Oh, definitely, yeah. Lovely people. I mean, I never speak to them. And from that, I gather that they are good private folk.
I think we're on a sort of can you feed the rabbits, can we borrow your ladder sort of relationship. But that's sort of what you want at the end. So this review is sort of only just starting. When will it bear fruit?
So we'll be publishing our first results before the summer, and then every 3 or 4 months thereafter, just publishing reports over 2 years.
We'll get you back on to find out how we're going to solve all these problems. Still to come, I'm really looking forward to this. We're going to talk about Richard Bergen. Oh, we'll be back after this.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Red Box podcast with me, Matt Chorley, joined in the studio by Will Tanner, Rachel Sylvester, and this is Matt Ford.
Labour's deputy leadership race is far more exciting than its leadership battle, largely thanks to one candidate, the character act Richard Bergen. Richard exists to widen the debate, especially if the debate is about whether it's ever a good idea for a politician to be deliberately thick or not. I'm captivated by Richard in a way that I never expected to be.
I totally agree. I've been sort of slightly fascinated by him for a while. About my Saturday column a couple of weeks on him, and I found myself sort of drifting down a rabbit hole of looking at his tweets from before he was an MP.
Wow.
And even then, it was just amazing. He's like obsessed with heavy metal.
Yes.
And he was sort of re-watching not that good films, which were a bit old, and declaring them sort of masterpieces.
Oh, brilliant.
And yet now, I got a message from a Labour spin doctor this week saying he felt a bit sad that Bergen had gone mainstream, that everyone had found out that he was a Wally.
Yeah. The first clip I ever saw of him was the Cathy Newman interview on Channel 4, where he's Shadow City Minister. And he gave two answers that I... purely by mistake, are hilarious. One of them is when he goes, I mean, I'm not a deficit denier. The Tories are deficit deniers, by the way. And she goes, how big's the deficit? He goes, well, it's bigger than it should be. It's simultaneously an awful and brilliant answer. And the other one where she says, oh, you're Shadow City Minister. How many meetings have you had in the city? He goes, well, I haven't. I've got a very busy diary. He's awful, but I think he gets away with it because he sounds slightly camp. He's kind of, oh, well, bigger than mine. It's a weird... And I think he's kind of realised that he's quite funny. And it's the first time I think now... I mean, obviously he deliberately misspeaks when there's the clip on Andrew Mark the weekend because we can't go back to the future. Go back to the past, you know. No. But I start to worry with these people. Maybe not worry, but maybe just notice... I think he's kind of doing it on purpose a bit now. I think he's realised I can get attention doing this.
So,
and he's dialing it up a little bit.
So there was... So just during this contest, we've had the peace pledge, which is a future Labour government would not support military action until they'd had an emergency conference.
I love it.
Could you just hold on for your with your missiles for a minute? We've got Brighton books. At the weekend, he was talking about how to re-engage. Basically, the... very areas you've been talking about, Will, by getting their local Labour CLPs to twin with parts of Colombia and Palestine.
That's right.
Because that's definitely what they're talking about in Bishop Auckland.
He just also... Justice twinning, he calls it.
Yeah.
My favourite law lords, justice twinning.
But the Tony Benn College of Political Education is just... Where did you start with that?
I just think it's wonderful that he's... I think all this stuff is deliberately provocative. And actually, if you look at the polling on the deputy leadership, Angela Rayner's still ahead. But she's kind of dropped around 25 points, and most of that has gone to Bergen. He's really kind of made a lot of heat. And I think a lot of the Corbynistas who'll be voting for Rebecca Long Bailey for the leadership thought they'd go for Angela Rayner, and they probably still will. But he's really made a play for that hard-left Labour vote.
Rachel, he was even asked by Andrew Marr at the weekend, people are saying you're just the continuity candidate, and he said, absolutely I am. like completely ignoring that everyone else is saying,
Rebecca
distance
Long-Bailey,
yourself.
10 out of 10 yeah. for Jeremy Corbyn. I think that's part of why it sort of, it seems so obvious that you have to do something differently. You can't, that's why it sounds so stupid to say you can't. And it's almost like, you know, the whole ideology is so... bonkers that he's got caught in that trap and he has to just ham it up more and more and more.
But he's talking to members all the time. So he's not talking to the country. Well, he sort of simultaneously is, but he's talking to Labour members who do think actually a Tony Benn university would be a good idea. And they do think they should have a say over military action. So he
says more about the Labour Party than about Richard Bergen, maybe.
Well, that's it. Well, of course, exactly. That's exactly what it is. And he's talking to basically 500,000 people, a lot of them are quite like Richard Burke.
Somebody, a colleague suggested to me yesterday that actually what he's doing is he's laying the groundwork that he is going to, in 30 years' time, he will be Jeremy Corbyn. He is going to be the long...
Yes.
This is not, whether or not he wins now, doesn't matter. Just drifting off, he will have a carrier bag full of leaflets sitting on the back benches, wearing a terrible suit, and just still coming up with these ideas. From a sort of Tory perspective, Will, what do you make of... the Labour Party and Richard Bergen?
I think Richard Bergen is the gift that keeps on giving. it was yesterday or the day before where he retweeted a news article about a quote of his own with just the one word, exactly.
Yeah.
And it was reiterating a point that he himself had made in violent agreement with himself in a very circular kind of political argument. And he is beyond parody, but for the voters in Grimsby or Bishop Auckland or Workington or wherever, he is exactly the wrong type of Labour politician and represents all of the values that were rejected at the last election.
I think it's also the sort of lack of self-awareness on the hard left, that they're so convinced they're right and morally superior and better than everyone else that they can't, there's no sort of self-questioning.
Yes.
That's the problem, Matt. If you're taking the mickey out of them, you Blairite,
yes.
Then they must be doing something right. It's your fault. You're encouraging them.
Yeah, I mean, he's been great for ticket sales for me, Richard Bergen. Every time he tweets something, I just retweet it with a ticket link. And it's brilliant. He's been a recruiting sergeant for my tour.
Are you doing Richard Bergen material in your show?
Of course. Yeah. I mean, even with my audience, a lot of people don't know who he is.
Yeah.
So I kind of have to explain who on earth Richard Bergen is. But he's funny for this reason. And then just go to town on him. He's brilliant. I'm very grateful for him.
Who else in your show are you doing that with? The sort of less well-known people who you're turning into stars.
Yeah, he's kind of the main one, really. Yeah. I suppose Rebecca Long Bailey a bit.
Do you do an impression of her?
Not particularly well, but that's true of most of mine. So I roll up and see some mediocre impressions. But he's kind of been the breakout star for me, really. He's like the new voice where I got a lot of mileage out of Ed Miliband and still get a lot out of Boris and Trump, but like he is at least... he's like a new thing that I think political people kind of find amusing.
Yeah, and actually people quite like that. I mean, in a, obviously not on the scale of yours, but I did my tour last year. Actually, people like the stuff that was about Paul Nuttall or Andrew Bridgen. It's a the beaten track.
Yes.
And they sort of, they're learning something. I mean, they're learning that someone is an idiot, but they're learning something. It's a sort of educational thing.
There is a bit of kind of tried and tested kind of tradition of this, isn't there? I remember Liz Truss, where she, all of the memes about pork markets and things, and then she suddenly turned that into her whole kind of political character, and it became a really key part of her persona. Mark Francois, too, is a good example of someone who has ridden the wave of social media memes.
I'm beginning to wonder...
Boris Johnson, even.
Well, exactly. He is the original one. Yeah. I'm beginning to wonder if the Mark Francois spoof Twitter account might be being run by Mark Francois. It is one of my favourite things. It's what the internet was made for. I can't believe it's called Mark Ne Francois Pas.
Yes.
I think. It is amazing because it's just about true enough. But it's like his idea of a patriotic breakfast. Was it a bowl of cornflakes with a can of Monster on it or something? It was really good. So Matt, if people want to come and see you, where are you and how can they get tickets?
Excuse me.
No, I'm afraid you've missed your opportunity.
No. This week I'm in Darlington, Hexham and Bedford and London next week on the 10th and 27th of March. And tickets for all dates available at mattford.com/live.
Fabulous. You've plugged your report, Will, from Onward. Have you got anything you want to shift,
nothing
Rachel?
Nothing to plug, no.
But you're just
nothing.
In the Times and very happy.
Yes, exactly.
Huge thanks, as ever. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, Acast, or wherever you listen. Do leave reviews. Lots of you have been leaving very nice reviews. So welcome to all of our new listeners who have been leaving nice reviews. You can leave horrible ones if you like. It still helps us up the charts. And don't forget to subscribe to my morning email at thetimes.co.uk/redbox. But for now, my thanks to Will, Rachel, and Matt. For me, Matt Chorley, it's goodbye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.